friend.
He hates you.
What do you know? You're just a kid. And imaginary.
Starring Bill Bailey and Sanjeev Bhaskar.
You're like the brother I never had.
I thought you had a brother.
I do, and he's nothing like you.
A new series of Sunday evening comedies begins with Henneke.
Henneke? Were you talking to yourself?
Yes.
No.
On BBC Radio 4. Available now on BBC Sounds. Well, now on Radio 4, Sarah Kendall concludes her short series of conversations with fellow storytellers. This week, she's talking to the author and screenwriter Nikesh Shukla about writing and the creative process.
All right. Well, shall we start? Nikesh Shukla, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Good.
Yeah, great. Yeah, I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm all right. I feel like I have so much to talk to you about, and I don't want to explode with all my questions in one go. I have just been looking at one of your writing tips, and it is about truth in writing. It was, what is truth? Writing a memoir is about writing down the truth. And it sent shockwaves through me because I have an absolutely reckless disregard for the truth. I don't care what really happened. I make people do and say things that aren't true if they serve the story. I don't know what's true. It's really thrown me into a tailspin.
I would qualify that with, I think memoir is an imperfect medium for telling stories, which I found when I was writing my memoir, like having written for screen and having written fiction, you know, you end up using all of those storytelling tricks in writing memoir. But it is a really imprecise thing because you're recording stuff that's happened in the past from your perspective, and you have to make a decision about whether you're narrating it from your perspective now, where what you're recounting has fallen through the sieve of your mind and what remains are fragments, or you're trying to put yourself back in the moment. You can't really remember those conversations. You can't really remember how people were standing or what they were wearing. And so I think memoir is about telling the emotional truth.
Yes.
I'm much more interested in the emotional truth of a moment than the how it happened. And I think an autobiography, by all accounts, is like a really long Wikipedia page, but broken into chapters. But a good memoir is answering a bigger question than just my life, you know? And a memoir has like a central thematic argument that you're trying to figure something out. And I think all good stories wrestle with a big question.
Yes, because that's the thing that I sort of struggle with, is where does nonfiction end and fiction begin? And something that I've found in my own work and creatively is that every time I tell a story, even just something, a thing that happened in high school, I'm rewriting it. Every telling of a story or an event is essentially a redraft, to the point where I'm not sure I can remember any of my stories in their original form. I don't really remember what happened. I remember the redrafts, and that worries me. Is that something that you find with memoir writing, and is that an uncomfortable sensation?
Yeah, it really is, because especially with this book, with Brown Baby, anyone who was there at the time might read it and have a completely different read of events. They might also not have appreciated my interior journey, but it's an interesting thing that you raise, because my second novel was pretty much about this thing that happens to us online. It's called Meatspace. And I became really fascinated with how we present these sort of curated versions of ourselves online. And what does that then mean for our offline selves? Because, you know, you tell a story, you spin a thing that's happened to you into like a super slick narrative that you can put up on Instagram or Twitter. And then you kind of then have to retell the story in real life, because invariably you run into people you know in real life who've gone, oh, I saw on Twitter you had a hilarious thing happen to you on the bus, and you may have like embellished it a little bit, and after a while you start believing your curated version of yourself that you've told.
Yes.
And that becomes who you are. But what does that do for your sense of self? And I just became fascinated with that idea.
That's a really interesting idea, that online personas allow you to essentially be an avatar in your own online world. That's sort of right. Like, what becomes more real? If we're spending this increasing amount of time online, which is the more real world? Is it the imagined world, or the world that you're living in?
And there's like this interesting push and pull between what is essentially an ephemeral platform versus the permanence of internet archive, of data archive.
Yes.
And where you may put your life and soul into writing a personal essay for a website about a very traumatic time in your life, and it goes viral for a week, and you know, you feel like, wow, everyone's really engaging with this thing that I've written, and then it disappears the moment the next amazing essay comes along, but it lives on the internet for the rest of time. It becomes data. Your story essentially becomes like, I was about to say bytes, but I didn't want to sound like a 40-year-old talking about the internet. It becomes data bytes on an internet website.
That's really, I'm fascinated by the limitations or the lack of limitations of the mediums that you and I respectively work in. I find the thing that would frighten me most about writing a novel is that it feels quite limitless. Like, for example, if I'm working within a live context, I know the show will be about an hour and I've got to get as many laughs as I can. That already means I'm going to cut away a lot of material. I'm going to be going for what's going to be as funny as I can, hopefully. It's only going to go for an hour. Even if I'm working in television, I know we've got budgets to think about. But with a novel, you can go anywhere at any point. It sort of feels like a recipe for insanity. That you can start in the Precambrian era and end in the next ice age if you want to. Like, I don't know how you face the multitude of options that you have at every juncture. I would lose my mind because they're so huge. I wouldn't even know how to calm myself down to take on.
But you do, because I think we're both employing the same technique. We are pushing for understanding and empathy, and then at the point where it might tip over into sincerity, we push for a joke.
Yes.
You know, that's what I was doing in those first two novels, and that's what I'm doing in the memoir. I'm always leading you to a point where I want you to, just when you're about to fall off the cliff into the abyss of despair, I'll make you laugh. And that laugh will just make you pause just for a second. And that's because, like, most storytellers know you've got like one or two gut punches along the way of a story. But the thing that you want to do is build up to someone being absolutely winded with emotion at like the moment of highest tension. And so in the memoir, I kind of front load very early that a lot of the reason I am the way I am, or have been the way I have been for the last 10 years, is because when my mum died, she died pretty much in the middle of an argument that she and I were having. And I let you sit with that, and I tell you all about her, and I tell you all about lineage and heritage, and I tell you all about my deepest, darkest fears, and then I hit you with the conversation that me and my mum had. And it's a very innocuous conversation, but it's the last one we had, and that's the point at which I want you to then, you know, I've made you laugh and I've made you like think all this time, but that's the point at which I want to explode that emotional grenade that's been like resting there for a while.
But do jokes release? Are you letting people off the hook with a laugh?
It depends who you're doing it for, right? Mm. Where I've spoken to stand-up friends of mine, they do have like certain audience members in mind. And I think it's really important to think of your intended reader. You're not necessarily, you know, I've been a great studier of stand-ups because, you know, I've been around like a lot of my friends doing it for a while, and like that's why stand-ups crop up in my work so much, because it's very easy to think that the stand-up is just going for the one big laugh all the time, that the whole room is always erupting. But actually there's such a subtlety and nuance in that, and I think that's because you know who your intended audience member is for those jokes. And for me as the writer, like I know who my intended reader is, and I know that my intended reader doesn't need to be faced with the abject horror of the trauma of what I'm talking about, because they're probably already going through it. Like The Good Immigrant and Brown Baby and the novels that for teenagers that I've written, I'm not writing them for like nice white liberal people who listen to Radio 4 on a Thursday evening, my favorite thing that people used to say to me about The Good Immigrant was, obviously I don't need to read this, for I am not a racist, but how are you going to get this book into the hands of the people who really need to read this?
Yes.
And which was interesting for me, because I realized we meant two different people. They meant, how are we going to gift this to my racist Uncle Paul and him read it and him renounce racism? And I just thought that was a really naive approach. Like, you can't really gift a book of essays to racist Uncle Paul, and then you might, you know, he'll call you up on New Year's Day and go, I'll tell you what, between Christmas and New Year, I mainlined this book, and you know what? I got it wrong. I am not racist anymore. When actually my intended reader for that book and for Brown Baby is like young people of color who feel very othered, who just need someone to tell them that their stories matter, that what they're going through is normal, and that there is space for them to tell their stories. And that for me is the intended reader. And they need a laugh. they need me to present them with the reality of what's going on and then undercut it with a joke, because they know what I'm going on about. And so I don't think I'm selling them short with a joke in those instances. In fact, I'm making it easier for them to kind of confront these horrible things.
Yeah. I mean, the intended audience is, I've sat in so many stand-up shows where it's the preaching to the choir thing, where, you know, there's a performer sort of talking about the politics and we're all laughing about it and we're all in our liberal bubble. And there are those moments. So there was a very funny, Peter Cook had that quote where somebody said to him, did Beyond the Fringe change the political landscape of the 1960s? And he answered something like, yes, much in the same way Weimar Cabaret stemmed the tide of Nazism. And I do kind of think frequently about, who am I writing this for? Why am I doing this?
Sorry to interrupt, but you just made me think of a thing. Like, I think so much of that is about just dropping your readers in the world, zipping the entry point up behind you and just showing it to them. Like, I often think that the hour-long Edinburgh shows I dislike tend to be the ones that, you know, have a title that is very on the nose about the theme, and then the comedian will come on and then spend the first 5 minutes telling you what the theme is and why they've decided that this is the theme, and then this is the theme, and then you then go on this journey. I'd much rather see like a storyteller kind of do something much more interesting with that, because I mean that's how you use fiction to kind of change people's minds. I mean, that's why that, you know, that James Acaster show where he's in witness protection, but he also wants to go on holiday, but he also wants a life change, but he also wants to talk about Brexit. And you don't realize until about halfway through that everything is a metaphor for this political thing that he wants to talk about. Like, that's the stuff that I think really moves people.
Because you said that, you know, you've got this interest in stand-up, and you obviously have a lot of stand-up friends. What's your experience with live performance? You've got your own. Do you want to go back and do more? Do you enjoy it? How does it?
I've got an interesting relationship with live performance. I spent a lot of my 20s as a very average rapper, and I just wasn't very good.
Wow.
You know, the thing about rap is, because a lot of the lyrics involve a lot of bravado, you have to be great or you have to be someone who's just got like an odd thing about them, like ODB. And I was like the worst kind of rapper. I was neither of those things. I was just average. And I didn't have the kind of the capacity or the meticulousness of the musician's brain to get better.
Right.
But it kind of took the fear of going on stage away from me. So like, what I don't like is what seems to happen a lot at the moment, where if you write nonfiction, you will invariably, especially about an issue, you'll be invited to, you know, show up at a very posh literary festival to argue whether racism is actually that bad with someone who thinks racism's not that bad. And that kind of binary bun fight thing, I really detest. I'm not good at it.
Yeah.
And I remember once I did an event for Arts Emergency where I was going on after Stuart Lee, which was very, very difficult prospect for a guy who's just going to read from his book, given that most of the people were there to see Stuart. And I was in the green room expressing this concern to Tin and Duyeb and to Josie Long, who was comparing. And Stuart overheard me and said, I tell you what you do when you go on stage, look a bit flustered and just go straight up to the microphone and say, I'm sorry, I'm so late. I only just got here. Has anyone good been on? And it will cut the tension. And I did it because I was really nervous, and I did that. Yeah. And just like it reset the audience, and it was so magical. And like only a generous tip from a stand-up like saved me in that prospect.
Yeah.
The other thing I did was I tried to write a storytelling show, like an hour-long storytelling show about my mum and about grief and about the power of food. when grieving someone. And so I wrote a one-person show where we took over a home, made it up to look like my home. I invited the audience round for dinner and I cooked them a meal and talked about grief for an hour.
The
power of like the food smells and, you know, making it quite a relatable, informal experience. As the audience entered, they were had to take their shoes off because that's what you do in an Indian household or most normal households. Who wears shoes around their own house?
And I'm not into it.
Me neither.
I don't like it either. No.
I find it sociopathic, but don't ever say that on Twitter because people get really mad at you. So I did this show and it was 10 shows in 7 days and I really learned what it was to be an actor in those seven days. And I realised it's not the life for me. It really wasn't.
Did you find, was there an emotional toll? Were you going to a place that was painful repeatedly? And was that a difficult thing to do? That's something that I certainly, I did a show where I had a fictitious character who dies. And after performing it for 40 or 50 performances, I'd come off stage sobbing because it felt so real to me at that point. Because I kind of had to go through like acting out this thing night after night after night, that started to become almost more real than real. I mean, how was that for you with your emotional and your mental health?
It was very hard. We had a 9-month-old kid at the time.
Yes.
And I think I had that thing where through over rehearsal, because, you know, I'm not an actor, I managed to get to a point of feeling distant from it. And then I did actual shows and I felt awful because I hadn't done my mum justice. And then I entered robot phase and then I entered I'm nearing the end of the run and I'm going to give it absolutely everything phase. And those last 4 or 5 performances were just, they were very raw.
Can I ask when you said, I hope you don't mind me asking, when you said I hadn't done my mum justice, what do you mean?
The conceit of the show was about how we memorialize people, how we romanticize them in death. We focus on the things that we miss, that are really good at them, about them, and we kind of roll our eyes at the bad stuff. And to truly mourn a person is to mourn their whole self. And so I wanted to talk about the everyday stuff and the mundane stuff and the stuff that she did just because it's what you do. And so that's why there was this focus on her trying to teach me to cook and me never wanting to learn. And then me trying to, okay, so like when we moved my father out of that house, when my mum died, because there was just a lot of memories for him, I was emptying the freezer and I found a Tupperware box of her old food and I didn't know what to do with it. And then I was like, I need to experience my mum's food one more time. And so I defrosted it and the kitchen just was suddenly transformed. This sort of empty, sterile, clean kitchen was transformed into my mum's kitchen again. And it was so transformative and powerful that I tried to recreate that on stage because I wanted to bring my mum back to life every night through cooking her food and filling, making a room smell like her kitchen.
Yes.
Because it was such an important room in the house.
Yes.
The kitchen was like the communal part of the room where everyone went, but it was my mum's domain.
Yes.
You know?
What I find really interesting is how unlike life art is.
Mm.
That's the sort of analogy with the writing saying about, you know, how do you do a statue of David? You chip away the bits that aren't David. I guess my version of that is I feel like when I'm writing something, I'm sitting at a keyboard and I'm hitting a bunch of keys repeatedly all over the place. And then after months, a melody starts to emerge. And then you go, I'm starting to pick up a melody here. But the blob of meaninglessness that I start with is so frightening.
Mm.
It's more like real life. It's messy, you know, and that's a really interesting requirement that we have from story is for it to be a lot more organized and on point than the chaotic blob of life.
Yeah.
I almost feel like my writing is a lie because everything has intention and a point and I have chipped away the bits that aren't David because real life is not like that. Is there a lie of story?
God, that's a good question because the moment you start conceiving of a character, which is what you're doing, whether you're writing, you know, a sitcom or a memoir or a novel, you know, once you know roughly the kind of the messy blob of theme that you kind of want to put on the page, you then have to start thinking about it in terms of the people who are going to occupy that space. And again, there's like an imperfection there, because you're never going to show the fullness of a person. You're only, you know, if the novel or the sitcom is about first love, you're going to show these two people falling in love, but you might not necessarily spend any time with his like pottery fascination, or like the fact that she yes. volunteers at a care home, or, you know, what have you.
Yeah.
I think the best characters are the ones who trick us into feeling that they are as complicated as people actually are, when actually yes. there's only so much of those characters we can show on screen. And yes. often the way we show characters as complicated in art is by making them make unexpected decisions in seemingly simple situations. Like, the classic sitcom trope of like, oh no, he's invited two girls to the same party and he's got to move between the two. Like, it would have been the easiest thing is to just say to one of them,
don't come.
Just to be honest.
Yeah. yeah. I think that that's a really, I do, because certainly, I mean, I don't have any experience in film writing, and I suspect with film and maybe with novels, I don't want to speak for a form that I've never worked in, but you can be a bit more loose. Whereas with TV writing, because of the sheer bulk of scenes that you've got to write, you have to be very disciplined. Like, often when a scene isn't working, you have to strip it down. You're like, why isn't this working? It's because too many people want too many things. You know, I need the character to walk in and they're going to want a thing, and they're either going to get it or they're not going to get it. They're going to have more hope or less hope at the end of the scene. If they walk in wanting two things and another person wants two things, that's not going to work. Well, but what I find hilarious about that is that that is so unlike life. The thing that makes the scene pop on the page and work when you're filming it is because it is so streamlined and it goes for three pages and a person wants a thing, as opposed to real life where you frequently walk into a room wanting nothing. I feel like story solves all of my real life problems.
Well, yeah, it's every scene is transactional. Every scene has a character make a choice, and the consequences of that choice create a new reality, which then lead us into the next scene where they're faced with another choice, which then their decision creates a new reality, which leads them. It's that thesis, antithesis, synthesis thing. Whereas like real life, you know, you don't show the bits where a person comes home from work and then just sit on the sofa and stare at their phone, unless they're going to discover that 2 hours ago they got a text message from their mum saying, call me now, dad's gone into hospital. The writer George Saunders once told me, I'm paraphrasing now.
Yeah.
He said, like, take the sentence, Dave walked into the room and sat down on the blue sofa. Let's look at that. Okay, so why do we need Dave to walk into the room? What is the function of him walking into the room? Can't he just already be in the room?
Yes.
Dave was in the room and he sat down on the blue sofa. Okay, well, we don't need to say Dave was in the room, so we'll just cut that bit out. Dave sat on the blue sofa. Why are we saying it's blue? Blue is kind of a nondescript color. There are very many different versions of blue. Like, do we want to be more specific? Why does it matter that it's blue? Okay, Dave sat down on the sofa. Well, do we need the action of Dave sitting down on the sofa unless it's for emphasis? Okay, Dave was on the sofa. Now we've got a sentence. Dave was on the sofa. Do we need the sentence? Gone. But that's life. Right. Like, Dave did walk into the room and sit down on the blue sofa. Like, that is life. But like, story doesn't require Dave to be sitting down on the blue sofa.
Right. Like, if two people aren't getting along, generally one person will leave the conversation. So keeping two people who aren't getting along well in the same scene requires a bit of a fudge. You know, and I had this just recently filming where I had the two characters really didn't like each other and they're sitting outside having a conversation, and they both said to me, why is this conversation continuing? Why hasn't one of us left? And then we actually just went, we're going to give one of you a cigarette. One of you has a packet, the other one wants one, and that's why you're staying, because this needs to happen for story purposes. And I hadn't even thought of that when I was writing it, because I was worried about story. I needed to get things plot-wise over the line with story, not thinking about the very basic question, why wouldn't one of them have just got up and left?
Yeah.
I don't know what my point is.
No, it is a great point, because like, the impreciseness of drama means, you know, that sort of like cliche actor thing of like, oh, what's my motivation in this scene? Like, we are not always dictated by motivation in everything that we do, right? Sometimes we just float through things. And sometimes the biggest note you get from development executives is like, oh, X is just very reactive. We need them to be very proactive. But, you know, half the time, like, I'm just reacting to my kids being very demanding. I'm not being proactive and going, oh, let's play a game that I've just invented. I'm just like, fine, I'll just put the TV on if that's the easiest thing to do.
But also, again, I think that that is one of the lies of story that does not correlate to the real world. I think in the real world, we are reactive. If 2019 and 2020 have shown me everything, or anything, I should say, everything that I have done has been in reaction to a pandemic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a very sort of modern conceit that we are masters of our destiny, because it's such an arrogant conceit that you're not just reacting to bigger events, that you are somehow the center of the universe dictating all these events. The reality is that all of us are just reacting. This idea that you're not reacting to world events or bigger forces is quite insane.
But I do think that's why you watch a disaster film or a film like Independence Day or a film like Armageddon, where the, like, world-ending things are happening. But the thing that we actually care about in Independence Day is, if Jeff Goldblum and his dad, are they going to get on with each other?
Yeah.
Is the drunk guy going to finally prove to his daughter that he's a hero? Is the president finally going to get over his grief for his wife? You know, those are the things that we care about.
I think there is an understanding when you go to see a disaster movie that if it's got Will Smith on the poster, that they're not going to kill Will Smith in the final 5 minutes of the film as the aliens smote planet Earth, because no one's going to want to see that. There is an understanding in that genre, we're probably going to triumph. Is that the understanding?
But I think that's why they give them the human interest story, is because ultimately, you know, Will Smith's going to make it, but you've got to give him some stakes, right?
Right.
You have to feel that in order for there to be some sort of dramatic tension throughout the thing. Yeah. So, like, it's really interesting what we put our characters through in order to kind of keep our intended audience engaged, but also keep them in the scene, as it were.
Right. Is that the sort of, I mean, one of my favorite descriptions of writing a script is, put your character up a tree and throw rocks at them. That's always my thing. Am I throwing enough rocks at them? What's the jeopardy? Are they in like, I want to keep that kind of momentum behind what I write.
Mm.
Is that what we're enjoying? Are we just enjoying watching someone having as many rocks thrown at them as possible? Because that's how we feel. Like, my life is just a series of rocks being thrown at me. I want to watch someone on the screen having bigger rocks thrown at them.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is the age-old thing of why we tell stories, right? Do we tell stories to hold up mirrors to ourselves and to other people? You know, there's that beautiful Zadie Smith quote in White Teeth where she says, there was England a gigantic mirror and there was Irie without reflection.
Mm.
Are we creating a mirror for Irie? Or in some cases, are we building windows, you know, so people can jump out the window into another... this metaphor is not working.
I was thinking jumping into the window. That's when you said building windows. I thought it was for me to jump in.
And then you're in a new world, right?
Right,
Yeah, so look, stories can operate on those two levels. And also the other thing is, we get so hung up on the why of telling a story and the intention of telling a story that it can sometimes lead us away from the fact that sometimes a story is just fun.
Yeah. Well, Nikesh, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for coming on and talking to me. I've enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sarah.
I feel like I know you.
Oh, we're going to be best friends now, I think.
Are we? I don't know if you're going to like me.
Sarah Kendall was talking to Nikesh Shukla.